What role should museums and archives play when it comes to preserving stories that haven't always been welcome into public memory? It's a question we continue to ask, especially during Pride Month and its surrounding months, when questions of visibility, care, and representation come into sharper focus. Welcome to Museums and Chill, the podcast of the International Council of Museums. In today's episode, we're exploring how LGBTQ2+ archives contribute to a more inclusive cultural record and how that work resonates far beyond the walls of any other institution. As ICOM continues its global revision of the Code of Ethics, these questions are more relevant than ever. What does ethical practice look like in preserving, sharing, and caring for community stories, especially those that have faced historical marginalization? And this conversation isn't just happening here. We invite you to join us at the ICOM General Conference, where we'll explore these ideas further, including a dedicated session on ethics of museum practice. Registration is now open, and you can find more information at icom.museum. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Payne, reference archivist at the Archives Canada's LGBTQ2+ Archives. Daniel brings a rich background in library and information science, musicology, and community-based teaching. He has worked in various roles, from head of reference services at OCAD University Library to teaching arts at the librarianship at the University of Toronto's iSchool. Welcome, Daniel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be joining you.
We're very happy that you're joining us as well. So I've read that the archives were founded in 1973, and maybe you can give us a bit of context of how it started and what's the aim.
So the archives started in 1973. We are an offshoot of the Body Politic newsletter magazine that started publication in 1971. It quickly became the mouthpiece of the entire queer and trans community across Canada. And they realized that a movement was occurring. So all these small kind of events that were going across in the country in various communities was actually part of a broader mass movement. And no other library, archive, or institution of cultural memory was preserving this movement. So it was incumbent on the publishers of the Body Politic to start an archive. So it started with a very small, you know, filing cabinet full of files. And since we have grown into the largest community-based 2S LGBTQIA plus archive in the world.
Thank you for that. Pride Month is often a moment of reflection for, of course, specifically for LGBTQ2+ communities around the world. From your perspective and from the archive's perspective, what role does the institution play in deepening the historical and cultural understanding of Pride beyond the celebration?
I kind of find the distinction between the political and the celebratory as somewhat arbitrary. For me, like queer and trans joy is political. I like to look to the philosopher Michael Bakhtin, who referenced François Rabelais, to conceive of the concept of popular laughter, a phenomenon that is one of the most lethal threats to power structures, given that it overturns hierarchies and upends existing social norms. Up until recently, queer and trans people were criminalized, medicalized, villainized, and denied basic human rights. So queer and trans lives were supposed to be sad, hopeless, lonely, dangerous, and fearful. Canada's first Pride event began in 1971 through holding picnics on the Toronto Islands, notably Hanlon's Point, a known queer destination since at least the mid-1900s. The first picnics were fun, playful, and campy, but it was still a time when queer joy was radical, even revolutionary. In Canada, we partially decriminalized homosexuality in 1969, but the surveillance, targeting, and entrapment of queer people actually increased afterwards. In response, we held the We Demand March in 1971 in Ottawa, our Canadian version of Stonewall, where 200 protesters stood on the steps of Parliament Hill asking for basic human rights. It was an intensely political maneuver, but Toronto's first Pride picnic was the impetus for this action, as was the founding of the Body Politic, an activism-based newspaper that I mentioned, published between 1971 and 1987. So we became an offshoot of that publication as well. So, under the understanding that no other institution of cultural memory was chronicling this archive. So for me, the joy of a picnic cannot be separated from the seriousness of protest work. So queer and trans liberation is a quest to liberate both the mind and the body through sexuality and sexual expression. Pleasure, celebration, laughter, and joy is one of the most direct ways for me to kind of connect these two domains and in turn liberate both of them.
And I guess that it's perceived also in cultural institutions, in museums, where we have to still show both sides of reality.
I think we can totally show that through our collections by not being so precious about what we collect. We have at least 40 different material types in our collection, so ranging from buttons to t-shirts to leather gear to drag queen outfits to swizzle sticks, coasters, you name it. Anything that's within the scope of queer and trans visual and material culture, we collect it. We're even kind of expressing joy and playfulness through what we collect. And I think that's a powerful message because archives are usually seen as so serious and so cerebral.
Maybe if you can tell us from your work at the archives, how can museums and cultural institutions expand their work with community-driven archives? What have you learned about introducing communities in the work?
Yeah, it's interesting in thinking about this question. I kind of gravitated towards three kind of central ideas. One of them is kind of related to what I was talking about earlier. Collect everything you can. And obviously, not all archives are going to be able to collect things. We have beer bottles in our collection with the beer still in it. So the question is, do we save, do we archive the beer or not? We can't because it's just too dangerous for the other items in the collection. So we're always dealing with issues like that. But the reason that we are so open in our scope about what we collect is because for much of, 2S LGBTQIA plus history, we were denied access to print media or other forms of public discourse. So clothing, buttons, handkerchiefs, t-shirts became our means of communicating amongst ourselves in the public sphere. So a great example of this is we collect matchbooks, which were kind of the social media of the pre-digital age. So for example, if you were out on the street and you see somebody and your gaydar starts going off, all you need to do is pull out a matchbook with a known kind of gay bar on it. For us here in Toronto, it would be the St. Charles Tavern. And immediately the person will recognize the reference. Then, of course, you would write your phone number on the inside covers. They've completely disappeared from our daily lives, but archiving them is such a testament to, how people lived in a given space and interacted with each other. For me, the visual and material culture of a community is a way to break down arbitrary distinctions between mind and body. Textual records show how people thought and felt about the spaces they lived in. Clothing and ephemeral artifacts show how we lived in these spaces. So, the second kind of idea that comes to mind is don't assume that an archive based on activism and fighting oppression cannot enact its own forms of oppression. The archives here in Toronto was an offshoot of the early first wave of lesbian and gay liberation. Its collections were shaped by the community worldviews of these groups. So much so that by 2021, when we hired an external consultant to do a collection review, we found that 68.2% of our collection represented cisgendered white male lives. This was a call to action for us. So, through a series of policy revisions, beginning with an acknowledgement of historical inequities in our collections, to revisions to our acquisition practices and collection descriptions, we're able to set the groundwork for creating a new collection development plan that will work towards diversifying and decolonizing our archival practices and our collections. So, like, even our name, the archives with a Q stuck right in the middle of it. It makes everyone stumble when they try and pronounce it. Trying to figure out, is it archwives? We get every permutation under the sun. But this is that kind of ideal liminal space that we want to create, where we're starting this whole process of querying archival practices. And then, thirdly, very quickly, I would encourage people not to put too many barriers to access in the interest of preserving materials. Welcome your community, not just in policies, but in practices. So, part of this process, and we do this actively at the Archives here in Toronto, is providing access to your spaces and collections for exhibitions, community events, meetings, community meetings. Make the archives a part of how the community functions in this public space. I always look to archivist Michelle Caswell, who, in her book Urgent Archives, Enacting Liberatory Memory Work, she describes the whole process. Community archives value people over stuff. What gets collected is only as important as it enables connections between people who use the stuff to share stories, transmit memory, and build relationships.
What you just shared reminded me of actually our last episode on the podcast where we have Miket, a Scandinavian art group that actually work with the museum, the National Museum of Norway, and they were asked to do an exhibition that had to include queer elements. The first thing they sort of thought of, at least from what they told me, was let's first see if at the museum there's anyone from the community that can help us already see the museum through their eyes. They did find this person that was able to help them work on the exhibition from already the inside space.
Yeah, totally. And we've been very active in social media and engaging with our community that way. We have a marketing and communications coordinator who is active in that realm. But ultimately, getting people into our spaces and interacting with these tangible objects of the past is the most meaningful, experiential way to really understand what we're doing as an archive. The Body Politic magazine is sourced all the time by researchers, and they're fully digitized through the Internet Archive and fully available. You can keyword search them, you can cut and paste from the electronic document. It's such a great way of accessing those periodicals. But 9 times out of 10, people that come into the archives, they want to put their hands on the newspaper to feel the newsprint, smell it. And I could look down on that as an archivist, but no, that's exactly what we do, is to put people face to face with the past, so that we can learn from it and move forward.
And with that in mind, how do you see the function of archives evolving?
Yes. I hate to use an overused phrase that we heard so much during the pandemic, but we need archives now more than ever. There's a kind of a traditional teaching in most Indigenous cultures in Canada where, in order to move forward, you need to look backwards. When you conceptualize this, it's a scary premise. Walking forward while looking backwards means you're going to fall down many times. But from the archival perspective, we need to know our histories and to seek the guidance provided by our elders in order to see our present pathways more clearly and plan for future directions. We thought we had won all the endless legal battles we launched from the 1970s onwards, from decriminalizing homosexuality to ending gross indecency laws to stopping the surveillance and purging of queer and trans people in the workplace to recognizing sexual identity in the Charter of Human Rights to gaining same-sex marriage. But it seems, however, that most of these seem to be rolling backwards one by one in our current age. So we need to learn the strategies of the myriad political and social organizations that fought these battles in the past and re-employ them in today's environment. Here in Toronto, a great example might be referenced through the bathhouse raids. So beginning on February 6th, in 1981, there was a landmark moment in Canadian history, really. So the night previously, the police had descended upon four legal establishments, bathhouses, and arrested 286 people, representing the second largest mass arrest of people in Canadian history to that point. It was a war on queer sexuality. Within one day, 3,000 activists were out on the streets demanding redress. And the reason people were able to literally mobilize overnight was a result of the strong networks of connections community groups had at the time, the small-scale printing presses that the community had access to, and the activism-based training queer and trans people had to employ in order to live their lives, their everyday lives, in an oppressive, heteronormative society. And I kind of fear that we've lost this community infrastructure and we've outsourced it to large corporations like Google, Facebook, or X, formerly Twitter. So I really feel like we need to own the means of producing our own narratives again so that we can respond to crises that drop on us like bombshells. And one of the most notable examples currently is how critical it is for us in the archive to build iron walls of protection around the transgender, genderqueer, non-binary, and intersex communities. So here at the archives, we're so honored to have the collections of Canada's earliest trans activist, Rupert Raj, in our collections. He transitioned in beginning in 1971 and immediately founded the Foundation for the Advancement of Canadian Transsexuals, or FACT. Next, he set up Metamorphosis Counseling Services in the early 80s and many other organizations. He also focused on publishing, starting with the Gender Review in 1978, 1982, he founded Metamorphosis and then Gender Networker in 1988. He immediately began reaching out to hospitals and healthcare facilities all around the world between the 1970s and the 1990s to inquire about their gender-affirming care and policies. He carefully preserved and maintained these collections so that we now have them in our collections and they're fully searchable through our database. So, this is an example of how learning from our elders will now help us fight these battles that need to be fought in our current age. So, essentially, at a most basic level, our mandate is to keep our stories alive. It sounds so simplistic, but it's actually a powerful stance given that throughout most of our entire history, we have faced erasure and oppressions from all levels of society. We have fought many battles against these erasures in the past, and we can learn how to fight them again through hearing the stories of our queer and trans elders. So that's our goal. It's a pretty tall order, but we're up for the fight.
We will continue with our conversation further with our community as we go and promote the episode and also promote the archives with a Q because I probably am not pronouncing the Q in there, but anyways, just so everyone knows, we have then come to the end of our episode. And I thank you, Daniel, so much for being here. And I really wish the best for the archives and for the work that you're doing. I think it's extremely important just to, as museums do, preserve the history of communities and of people.
Yeah, thank you.
As we reflect on today's conversation, here's something to leave you with. What does it mean for museums and archives to be trusted, not just as institutions of memory, but as place of care, dialogue, and possibility? Thank you for joining us on this episode of Museums and Chill. To learn more about this episode or to join the conversation at the upcoming ICOM General Conference, visit icom.museum.